Atheist Nomads episode 356, some good news out of Australia.
The podcast you're about to listen to includes cursing and talking about hoo-haws. Please be advised.
Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. I am Dustin, and in a little bit I'll be joined by Justin Miller, who we had on back in episode 270. And we're going to be talking about... It's a follow-up to the interview we had back then. 270, that was like... year and a half ago, and the work he was doing on trying to get some chaplaincy for humanists in the Australian military has made some progress. We actually have good news, and here in 2020, getting good news seems like such a rare thing, especially for us with the Trump administration and all the conservative governments that have been taking over and pushing theocratic bullshit across the world. And all right, we got some progress, so that'll be good to get to. And of course, you know, I did make a goof, so the sound quality will be a little bit different during the interview than right now, and then at the end when I go through feedback, because I didn't record my own channel. Fortunately, with the new mixer, part of why that happened was I didn't want to slide it out far enough to actually be able to see that light, which I need to make sure that here in the future, and I need to fix this right now, that I actually slide the mixer out on the end table far enough that I can see all of the channels, so I can actually see my own and see that it is recording. But I did record the master stereo mix, so I used that to take care of the levels. I did have to do a lot more compression, so, and then a little EQ to take care of some of the negative effects that compression is having. So yeah, it'll be a little bit different than usual, so hang in there. And I hopefully have just learned my lesson now, because I've been doing this for 8 years and make a flub up, like not even recording my own track. One of the reasons for this mixer, though, was to cut down on some of that complexity by having a device that just does it, and have the master mix and the individual tracks so that I can use whichever one's better in case I mess something up like that. So it did do its thing. So hooray. And before we get to the interview, there are a couple things I do want to need to talk about. First up, I did record with Not Your Grandmother's Book Club. Should be on their episode that was released, should have been released yesterday, as of the day of release of this episode. Where we went through chapter 10 of Donald Trump Jr.'s book called Triggered. And, oh, goddamn, that was bullshit. Horrible to read. But we had a lot of fun calling bullshit on, like, all of it. So, yeah, check that out. Should be a lot of fun. And then, of course, and just kind of catching up with a little bit of news, since I do have the time to do that right now. Like Arkansas has got a coronavirus outbreak going on right now because of a church. Yep. When you open up churches and expect them to do everything right, some will, some won't. And the evangelicals and charismatics that are in the cult of Trump are definitely probably most likely to be thinking, this isn't a real big issue because Trump said it's not a big issue, but it is a big issue, but it's not a big issue, but it is a big issue. Yeah. So, yeah, they had an Arkansas church in March 6 to 11 had 35 out of the 92 people there come up positive. It was back in early March. It was still really starting slow spread outside of, you know, the major coastal metropolitan areas. But it hit Arkansas, and yeah, just a couple church services infected 38% of the people that were there. And then those 35 people turned around and infected another 26 people because of contact tracing that was done, and it did actually kill three of those 35 church members and one of the 26 mostly family members of those church members that were infected. And both the pastor and his wife got it as well, which caused them to close down the church indefinitely on March 12th. And we keep seeing more of these. Like, you look in California, there was a Mother's Day church service that resulted in nearly 200 people having to be quarantined because one person tested positive right after that service. And, you know, you look at a lot of states that are reopening, which every state now has at least partially reopened. And they've been, for the most part, either because of courts forcing them to, or just governors saying, yeah, let churches do their thing, have been letting churches handle it themselves. Like, Idaho has reached level two of stage two of the reopening plan, which does allow churches to fully reopen and manage their own response to it, because the assumption is that the churches can handle it and work out, you know, maintaining social distancing and cleaning their hands and all that kind of stuff. That's assuming that they take it seriously. Like, you look at the more mainstream churches, and yeah, they are taking it seriously. But you look at the super fundamentalist ones, they aren't. And this is going to backfire when you have groups of people all getting together where most of them are old and have horrible immune systems. Yeah, the churches are where we're going to be getting some of the biggest outbreaks. And what's kind of crazy is as the reopening continues, you're going to be getting more family gatherings and old people going to churches and getting COVID-19 and then hanging out with their grandchildren, who will then get it. And children are not, you know, especially really small children, are not capable of understanding social distancing at all. So once they get to the playground, they'll all mingle and spread it to each other and then spread it to everybody else. And then, yeah, it spreads everywhere. Wave two is coming. And this is, I definitely suspect churches are going to be a huge, huge part of it. There was also the Holy Ghost Catholic Church in Houston, Texas, reopened once the state allowed them to. And they have had to cancel public mass indefinitely again, with the entire religious order of priests in quarantine. So far, at least one of their priests have died who might have had it, wasn't tested, but probably did have COVID-19. And out of the, I guess, other four priests who were in that order living at that church, yeah, they're pretty sure they all have it. Two have already tested positive, and they were active in celebrating public masses at the Holy Ghost Catholic Church since it reopened on May 2. And they closed it down around May 18. So yeah, some of those masses, and if they were doing standard mass protocol, then that would mean somebody with COVID-19 was placing crackers into people's mouths. And they were all sharing a cup of wine. Yeah. Even if everybody who went in had their temperature checked to get in and had to use hand sanitizer, the odds that those priests didn't touch their faces or breathe on their hands and then put crackers in people's mouths, and everybody shared communion wine, if they did do standard public mass, oh, that's going to be bad. That's going to be really, really bad. And of course, this is one of those where 14 to 21 days after exposure is when people start to become symptomatic. We won't know how bad that's going to be for several weeks. And in all likelihood, you know, it could have been that those priests caught it from somebody who came in as soon as they reopened, and conceivably could have spread it to everybody else that came to that church, because that's how viruses spread. And for some not COVID-19 related news, the president of the Humanist Association of Nigeria was arrested on April 28th, taken from his home to a neighboring state, Kano, which has Sharia courts and where blasphemy is a crime. Mubarak Bala is a former Muslim, which if you get into any kind of a Sharia court, that does not bode well. And this is actually a second time of running into issues with the law there. In 2014, he was institutionalized for renouncing Islam. And basically since then, he regularly gets harassed and gets death threats. It's been almost a month since he was arrested, and nobody's heard anything from him really since. No charges have been officially filed, and he hasn't had access to any legal counsel. This has gotten a public condemnation from the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, as well as the European Union and several other countries. But we still don't know what's going on. Realistically, he's probably dead already. And that really sucks. News for now. Let's go ahead and get to the interview where we can actually get some good news. Because we all need good news. From Australia, he is a humanist chaplain that has been on the podcast before in episode 270. That was back in September of 2018. And a lot of stuff has happened since then. So, Justin, can you tell us about what you're doing now?
Oh, hi. Okay. Nice to be back. Thanks, Dustin. So, as Dustin said, my name is Justin Murray. I'm a humanist chaplain here in the ACT, which is the capital of Australia. I'm a humanist chaplain at our major hospital and also at one of our major universities. So, some time ago, I had a conversation with a lawyer who's a friend of mine, who's a constitutional lawyer. So our constitution is somewhat similar to the American constitution in that we have a clause about the separation of church and state. In the Australian constitution, that's section 116. It deals with not making any laws in regards to religion or the operation of churches. It goes a little bit further than the American constitution. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting read. Obviously, it was written around the end of the 19th century, so drawing a lot of experience from around the world.
Yeah, 100 years worth of experience.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And really, it sets out four principles. The key one that interested me was this idea that there should be no religious test for any Australian federal government position. And the federal government shouldn't remunerate any practice which is a practice having to do with religion. So it's very clear. It's about the test for religious-based activities. Now, my question to the friend of mine who was a lawyer was, well, we do have chaplains. We have a number of different chaplains in Australia. We have them, unfortunately, in federally funded and state-funded public schools. There have been high courts, so that's our highest court is the highest court. The High Court of Australia is our highest court. There have been some tests in regards to the funding of those chaplains, but what
right and these
been
these chaplains
was,
these chaplains yeah. are in primary and secondary schools, right?
Yes.
So everywhere from like 6 and 7 year olds all the way up into teenagers.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Which would be grossly illegal in the U.S.
yes, and we have a slightly different system. We have a similar system to the U.S. We have a federalist system where states and we have some territories are supposed to be independent and do pretty much all their own setting of laws and their own governing. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the funding for public schools actually comes via the federal government. They have a much broader tax power to regulate in regards to anything that comes in from overseas or has to do with a foreign government. For education comes from our federal government. And what they were doing, they were actually funding people to go into public schools directly in order to proselytize a version of Christianity. Now, the test was taken up by a friend of mine, and he actually was successful in stopping the funding, the direct funding of chaplains in schools. Now, the way that the federal government got around that is just to go, well, we don't directly pay the churches, we'll pay the states, we'll pay the churches. So not a great outcome, and certainly basically a direct attack on that section 116 of our constitution. For me, it was being tested, and the federal government had lost, but they'd found this workaround. So the other part which interests me was, well, what about that test for, should there be a religious test for a government-funded public position, a trust or position in our public service, or in this, in my case, in the military? Mm-hmm. So I actually figured, well, it looks to me as though the federal government is directly funding military chaplains, and that would be okay, kind of, except that they were all religious. There was no other options.
Right.
So I sort of set out a game plan, and that game plan was to apply to the military and be quite upfront and say, look, I am actually a chaplain. I meet the requirements for at least a minimum of three years service as a chaplain. I hold two positions. I hold the necessary qualifications, what we call CPE. I also hold four qualifications. So I hold, which is I've kept current for years. I have the skill set. I just don't have the belief in a deity. Will you allow me to apply for the position? And their answer was no, they will not allow me to. So my next step was then to take that complaint to, we have a Human Rights Commission here in Australia, and that operates at the federal level. So because this was a federal position, I applied to the Federal Human Rights Commission to say, look, I feel that this requirement to be religious is a breach of the Human Rights Act. What do you think? So they had a look at my case and they accepted my complaint in a little bit of a rebellion in that it wasn't necessarily a direct breach of the Human Rights Act, but there were some International Labour Organization agreements that Australia had signed which were around religion, so they can't test the constitutionality of it, but they can look at legislation or agreements that the Australian government has agreed to, and they said yes, we'll accept your complaint. It is a valid complaint. So I entered into a mediation process.
How much power do the Human Rights Commissions have?
Oh, okay. So they have full mediation powers. So they can actually direct an employer to undertake a particular set of reasonable actions. Which could include either allowing someone to apply for a job, re-employing them if they've been fired for an unreasonable, for something unreasonable, or in my case, they might actually mean that they might have to allow me to be employed if I met all the requirements except for the religious requirement.
Okay, and that would be something where they have the power to actually enforce that and not just have to take it to the courts to enforce it.
No, they would have the power to indicate a decision and have an enforceable outcome. Yeah, absolutely.
Wow, nice.
So they actually, it's a good system technically, but in explaining all that I explained, it actually is interesting that the decision that they came to, I can't talk about the technicalities, but what I supplied in detail or what the other side supplied in terms of our Department of Defense. But I can talk about the outcome. So the outcome essentially was that they found that there is a religious test for those positions of military chaplains, and they were okay with that. Their position was it was a requirement of the job to have a belief in a deity in order to undertake the work. So that's an interesting outcome.
Yeah.
It means my case to them fell apart. However, passing it legally, left me in an interesting position because there would actually be the end to take that to, depending on the jurisdiction, it's a little bit complicated, but if I were, say, to apply here where I live in Canberra, in the Australian Capital Territory, I would be able to apply to be employed here And then if a religious test was applied, I could then apply to our local Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission mm-hmm. and see how that went. Or I would actually have standing because then it would become an open, like an open question or controversy in terms of the law of it. Well, there's this test, and it's been found to be a test which is necessary for employment, and then that puts that in conflict. That decision is in conflict with the Constitution.
Well, and it's one of those things that is kind of tricky because if you know, generally speaking, when it comes to illegal. Like, there are things that are discrimination unless you're discriminating for good reason. Like, in most civilized countries, you can't discriminate against somebody for employment because that person uses a wheelchair. Unless the job requires standing 8 hours a day, then that person doesn't meet the qualifications for the job due to not being able to fulfill the physical requirements of the job and thus can't do it if there is no reasonable accommodation that can be made. Granted, when you're dealing with a no religious test clause in a constitution, like the U.S. has as well, that theoretically would mean that position is incompatible with government employment altogether and needs to be eliminated.
Yes. So that is the outcome. However, so I had some close contact with, and I have to thank Professor Luke Beck, who's a constitutional lawyer at Monash University, where that's where I actually studied for some of my time in academia and taught there as well. He was really useful in this whole process and provided me with some really good advice about how to proceed. When we got to that point, it was very clear on paper that it appeared to be unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, you kind of at this point, a bit like Ron Williams, who took the case about the funding of chaplaincy to our High Court, you have a couple of options. You can now suck it up and say it's unconstitutional, but I'm not going to go any further, or you can attempt to take it to court. Pretty much his advice was, you're an individual citizen, government has a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
You're technically correct. Do you want to spend a lot of money on this and have the opportunity that you get to the end and you have to cover your fees and you have to cover the government's lawyer's fees because unlike the US, we don't have a pay for yourself system. We can actually have damages awarded. So if my case was seen to be frivolous, I might have to pay my costs plus the Commonwealth's costs.
Ouch.
Which could be millions of dollars.
Yeah.
So
especially if that went to the High Court.
Yes, absolutely. We're talking, I'm not sure exactly if you have an equivalent, but we have multiple layers of qualified lawyers in Australia. We use the English system, so we have barristers, solicitors, barristers, and then we have Queen's Counsel. And they're the really expensive ones, the Queen's Counsel. And it could possibly run into the millions of Australian dollars of having to pay their lawyers.
You know, the U.S. doesn't have a system like that, but I guess the equivalent would be lawyers have to be admitted to the bar for whatever that covers whatever court they're going to be appearing before.
Mm.
So some lawyers are admitted to the federal bar for certain districts and can go to federal courts in those districts. Other lawyers aren't in the federal bar. They're only in the local bar, so then they can only go to state courts.
Yeah.
And so there's that, but it's not a particular like a class system. It's just what do they need to do their job?
Mm. Yes, absolutely.
But like the lawyers that go to the Supreme Court are super expensive.
Yes. So that's that's essentially the equivalent. It's constitutional experts, no matter where you are going to cost you a lot of money. And when you possibly have to pay for both sides, that basically means it's not an option to proceed. I didn't understand at the time going through the process of the human rights complaint and then the outcome was that my actual complaint was being fairly closely watched. I had contact from chaplains who were in multiple different services, Navy, Army and Air Force, and they were personally concerned about where this would go. sometimes right. for personal reasons, but generally I had some really good and interesting contact with people around the behind the scenes stuff, which I think I mentioned before about some people being, for example, out in limited ways as atheists or humanists, mm-hmm. but not being able to be out because of the current power structures. I had interesting information told to me. None of this verified, of course, that possibly some of the churches were using the chaplaincy as a way of basically getting tax-free dollars from the federal government. They mm-hmm. would take the whole wage of their chaplain and then provide back basically a stipend or a smaller amount for them. And
I'm pretty sure that's the way it has to be for Catholics because they take a vow of poverty.
Yes.
Yeah, if you've taken a vow of poverty, you can't earn an income. You have to just take the little stipend they give you.
Yes.
That income has to go somewhere.
Yes, it does. And of course, that would all be fine, of course, except, you know, once again, on paper at least, that looks like a breach of our constitution, because mm-hmm. essentially the federal government is sending money directly to a church. It's not meant to go to the church, but the way it was set up behind the scenes mm-hmm. is that it would go directly to them, because that's how the chaplain will be paid and then pay their wage to their church and then receive back money. Like for transparency, you know, there would be plausible deniability. Oh, we didn't know that was happening. The government could say, right. But certainly that look good on paper. So it was generally good contacts. The really interesting ones were the contacts I had from people in the United Kingdom who were attempting at that time to introduce some sort of secular option within their military chaplains mm-hmm. and were having limited success. I also didn't know that within the Australian Defence Force itself, there were people advocating for secular options or the taking out of the power of the churches from the selection of chaplains, including our Royal Australian Navy. So it was actually quite good timing from my understanding for both of those groups in that while I was unsuccessful, it provided a little bit of impetus, you know, to say that, you know, our services as chaplains are actually of interest to the public and what we're doing is being watched. Mm-hmm. And there is the possibility now that the Human Rights Commission found that it was necessary to have a religious test to get a position of a chaplain. They found that was legitimate, that then there was basis, there was a live case or controversy to take to the courts in Australia. So that really provides some really good impetus to then change things. In fact, only on the 11th of May, there was an announcement from the Royal Australian Navy that they're actually... what they're doing is they're making a whole lot of changes to their chaplaincy service. Mm-hmm. Now, I've had a brief conversation with the head of chaplaincy and with the head of Navy, which not something I ever expected to be having. And that was, both those conversations were really interesting because what they had been saying is that behind the scenes, they'd been working very hard to introduce some changes. And while, in their words, some interesting things have been said about what I was doing, they were very glad that, you get what I mean by that. They were very glad and very happy about the timing of it because they had been attempting to introduce something. Now, the wording is not perfect and some of the things around this are not perfect, but really, from my point of view, it's about there's not in this sector, there's probably not going to be radical change. We're not going to see religiosity and chaplaincy stripped out of the military services here anytime soon, but we can or take anywhere. Some baby steps. Yes, but we can really take some baby steps towards something which looks like a service which actually offers the kind of things like love and compassion and listening and holding hope and really making sure that people have meaning in their lives. All those things are really important to me as a humanist chaplain, mm-hmm. And I think we're making those baby steps towards ensuring that those services are actually are available to everyone. So what they had in mind, bearing in mind the wording is not perfect, But they had in mind this thing they wanted to introduce in the Navy called a Maritime Spiritual Wellbeing Officer. Now, I don't know. I've been around chaplaincy for a while and religion for a while. Obviously, as an atheist, you know, I usually have, you know, more interest in religion than the religious. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's the way it is. So I don't really know what that word spiritual means. But
That kind of sounds almost to me like what it reminded me of was, it was actually a position I held in Civil Air Patrol back when I was in the seminary. And a theology student did my undergrad, where it was called, the position was moral leadership officer. So it was for a layperson who got the sign off of their pastor or other religious leader endorsing them, not endorsing, because that actually has a specific meaning, but approving them to fill this role, to fill in kind of like a chaplain, but not a chaplain.
Okay.
And I got that appointment because I wasn't a pastor. I didn't have a Master of Divinity. At the seminary, I was working on a Master of Divinity. And to actually get to be a chaplain in Civil Air Patrol is the same exact requirements as, and has to go through the exact same channels as to become a chaplain in the actual uniformed armed forces. And so, it was a weird title that... the one you're describing sounds kind of like.
Yes. And it would, like, I think if on the surface, if I heard that, if I heard the word chaplain, I'd probably be, like, if I wasn't in the position that I am, being a little bit more cautious about any of those terms, I would probably be, you know, alarm bells ringing. This is really, you know, a Trojan horse for religiosity. But when I had chats to the Navy and we digged a little bit deeper, they made it very clear that what they're actually trying to achieve here is a professionalized, non-religious pastoral care. And they've actually put a whole lot of requirements around that as well. So they actually, like, you know, unlike, I'm not sure about for you, but certainly if you want to and you have the money to, you know, set up your own church, anyone pretty much can call themselves a religious leader in Australia. So there are more requirements if you belong to, you know, some sort of mainline church, etc. But it's pretty much, you know, they're very, very loose requirements around that. Chaplaincy is a little more gatekept in a way, in that you have to belong to, at least, you know, depending on where I work, you have to belong to a church, an established church, and then you have to meet their requirements. But I guess the good thing from my point of view around this was they actually started to introduce and have introduced and have approved within the military structure that people to take up these maritime spiritual wellbeing officer roles actually have to have full qualifications, at least a bachelor's degree in what they call a human services discipline.
Okay.
So you're talking psychology, social work, social science, something of that sort. So actually, you know, you actually have to have a skill base and a recognized skill base in order to simply apply, rather than just having, you know, some sort of religiosity, a belief in a deity and belonging to our church. They're meeting those churches' requirements. So, like, that was digging a little bit further, that gave me a little bit of, quite a bit of hope that they were heading in the right direction.
And is this going to replace the chaplaincy, or does this augment the chaplaincy?
This is a very good, that's a very good question. So my understanding was, it would be to augment it in that way. Religious chaplaincy will stay in place and will remain, in their words, an integral part of what they do. But they actually, one interesting thing is they've actually introduced a whole lot of other stuff around that. So they've introduced separate insignia. Now, this sounds like, you know, a relatively unimportant thing, but what it will mean is that if you are approaching a person and they identify as a chaplain, you'll actually be able to tell immediately whether they are religious or non-religious. They will have separate insignia and separate badges on their uniforms.
The U.S. military does do that with various crosses for specific denominations, and then Unitarians have their, I think it's a lamp, and there's Hindu and Buddhist and the Star of David for Jewish chaplains. And
yeah, I guess that we didn't have that here as far as I know before. So you kind of, it was a bit of a lottery. You didn't necessarily know what you were going to get.
Oh, wow.
Whereas now it will be at least a little bit more clear what you're going to get. You'll be approaching a person who, you know, is non-religious, is, you know, secular in their approach to pastoral care and won't be interested in proselytizing or any of that sort of, you know, that sort of thing. They will be there simply to provide pastoral care. And part of their role with that, they'll have to be able to, they will be required to respect other people's beliefs and not to present any of their own.
Okay. So and for listeners who might think pastoral care sounds inherently religious, could you describe what you mean by that term in this context?
Pastoral care. Yeah, okay. So I guess, you know, not being someone who has the ability or interested in any sort of religious rites, I have a very practical approach to what pastoral care means. It means for me and three things. In fact, interestingly enough, I have three stepsons, and they just asked me a really interesting question. They said, if you, I think this was in regards to their homework there. Two of them are at home at the moment because of isolation. And the eldest one asked, if you could do any job, what would you do? And my response back was, well, do you mean do it for money or if money wasn't a concern? And he said, oh, if money wasn't a concern. So I said, I would do chaplaincy. And then he asked the question, well, why would you do that? And my response to your question is the same as to him. There are three parts of chaplaincy as far as I'm concerned. Every human being needs to have a sense of meaning and purpose in their life. Chaplaincy for me, or pastoral care, in general terms, means helping a person hold and create meaning in their life. That may come about through certain rituals, or it may not. There are rituals which I'm happy to engage in if people like them, and that adds meaning to their life. The second part, and that's closely related to meaning for me, is hope. Hope is, or appears to be for many people, integral to living a worthwhile life on their own terms. So it's those two things, but mostly that's achieved through the very practical approach of listening to people. My approach is basically it copies the mental health first aid or psychological first aid approach, which is to listen and listen intently without judgment, to be adaptive to the person and listen to them and respond to them in ways which they want. And hopefully the outcome of that listening is to encourage meaning, the creation and sustenance of meaning, and to hold and sustain hope in their lives. If I can base all pastoral care on those three things, that's what I would do. Now, I don't think that's any different for any other chaplain or any other person in that kind of role. It's just that for me, it's devoid of any belief in the supernatural. It's devoid of any rituals.
I did a quarter of chaplaincy at an hour a week and one weekend during that quarter in college. And I was a religious person, and it was in a religious context at a religiously owned hospital. And when I do my hour of rounds, those conversations I would have was listening to people, and if it provided value, provide religious ritual, and if not, don't.
Yes,
absolutely. And the key to it was listen.
Yes, absolutely. I 100% agree. I guess the thing for me is that the ritual itself, my background is in social psychology and sociology, and so I understand the value of ritual, in particular in regard to meaning and hope, and also in regard to how people see that they fit within their community, which is linked to meaning and hope. So there are some rituals which are really important. Personally, I have done weddings and I have done memorial services. So there are rituals which I will engage in. And certainly when it comes to providing emergency listening or emergency pastoral care, I've provided that to people who are religious, and that has involved praying with them. Mm-hmm. I may have mentioned it before, but my position on praying is that I'm happy to do it if it's important for the person who's in front of me. It carries no inherent meaning for me, but I could see that it has meaning for others. And it, in particular, it holds hope for them. Right. Like if pressed, I would say, well, there was a little bit of data around that. There are some functional magnetic resonance imaging studies which show that there is value in praying of a certain kind, mostly around gratitude or where you're talking about, you know, things that are good in your life, and then praying is an adjunct or part of that. There's some really good stuff around that.
Well, similar to studies on meditation.
Yes, absolutely.
That prayer done well is basically just meditation.
Yes, absolutely. So there is some data around that. So that would be my position. But primarily it's a humanist focus, and you know, humanism is a set of beliefs which are unjustified by the available evidence. But I'm happy to roll with them because it seems to me that humanity and people are worth more sometimes in some situations than data. Maybe controversial opinion, I don't know, but that's why I think of myself more as a humanist than an atheist or a skeptic. So,
there would be no benefit in trying to break somebody's faith who is about to go into surgery or is dying.
No.
I think almost every atheist would agree that would be a dick thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes it can go, I've been in situations in the hospital where it goes maybe even a step further. So I attend to people who are not religious at the hospital, which can actually lead to situations where I'm attending to a person who has no faith, but their family does. And there have been multiple situations where I have had people who are atheists or agnostics who are dying. Generally, they're very easy to talk to and very accepting of where they're at in their life. Families can be a little bit more difficult. Mm-hmm. And my position in that case would be, I've said this to people, to grieving family members, my personal position would be that the people left behind are more important than the person who is gone, because that person is gone. Mm-hmm. Essentially my value system comes back to humanism more than anything else. There have been instances where people have wanted a religious service for a family member who was an atheist. And my suggestion for them to take or not would be, you're left. This is valuable to you. Consider, their wishes, but also remember that they're no longer around.
They
may believe that they're around. And that they may think that, people are watching from the sky or whatever. That would be my position. But, it's the people left over that are more important to me. So, just that's what I would see as pastoral care. It's about attending to the person in front of you on their terms and in a way which they can essentially live with and be comfortable with. That makes me glad, because it seems to be that kind of approach is what the Royal Australian Navy is taking now. They are in a position where pretty much 50% of the people that belong to the Navy are no longer affiliated with any religion. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean they're atheists or agnostics, but they're not affiliated with a religion. But they're wishing to continue that sort of very human-based pastoral care in some way. Okay. So my conversations around that were around, how do we provide that humanistic approach now that we have people who don't identify as belonging to a religion? That's how they're going forward. Yeah, go ahead.
There's a part of it to me that kind of sounds like this is separate but equal. So I've got some technical questions to ask that hopefully the command staff you talked to answered. Mm-hmm. But are these maritime spiritual welfare officer? Was that the title?
Yeah, well-being officer.
Officer. Okay. Are they going to be a part of the chaplain corps or their own separate corps?
No, they will be part of the chaplaincy corps, as far as I understand.
Will they enter the Royal Australian Navy at the same rank as a ordained minister who's getting the title of chaplain.
They're on that's a technical thing, but they will be on a separate award. So there's a thing in between, which is called the Defence Force Remuneration Tribunal. So they obviously are a legal board who looks at the way which military personnel are not only paid but remunerated for. There's a whole lot of stuff around uniform allowances and other allowances
and things like degree level and the like. I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And because they're essentially sidestepping the requirement to be approved by the chaplaincy board, and there are the requirements for holding at least a bachelor's level degree, they are a separate class under as far as the Defence Remuneration Tribunal is concerned, but they will be part of the chaplaincy corps.
And entering at a bachelor's level position rather than a master's level position, yeah, there would be a definite difference there.
Yes.
Okay.
I would have to look up the exact ruling from the tribunal in terms of what any differences in pay. I haven't had a chance to do that, but these are very important questions. So they are, in a way, separate. I'm not sure to what degree they are equal, to use your terminology there.
And in the Australian military, do chaplains hold rank like other officers do?
Yes, they do.
Okay, so then you would theoretically have, within a single, professional service, chaplains and spiritual well-being officers, both rising up the same track to where you could conceivably have a chief of chaplains or whatever the title is, who is a maritime spiritual well-being officer.
Yes. And that's not unprecedented. From what I understand, for example, of the chaplaincy service under the NHS or the National Health Service in the UK, their current head of service is actually a humanist. She is actually a humanist chaplain.
Okay. Huh. That'd be interesting.
Yeah. So that would be a technical possibility. And that could, I guess, from my point of view, not altogether be a bad thing. I guess because of the humanist, the position is a one where all forms of belief are equal. Mm-hmm. And so there's not really any chance, I guess, in a way that you could say, there will be it will be much more difficult to be preferential in the way that you provide services or access if you were to be, a humanist head of a service, unless there's some sort of, unknown or untoward bias in the way that you acted. So, So I'm just having a look, just in regards to your pay question, I'm having a look at the determination from the review tribunal now, and the chaplaincy division has a separate pay scale from that of the maritime spiritual welfare officer. However, the classes match, so there are four divisions or classes of remuneration, starting for chaplains at $86,697 per year, and rising to Division 4's highest level of $156,637 per year.
Whoa.
And those, it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And those are exactly copied for the Maritime Spiritual Welfare Officers.
Okay.
So they're exactly the same divisions and same pay levels according to what class they're at, that the person is at. So, yes, the pay levels will be the same. But, of course, as noted, the requirements around employment will be different.
Right. Okay. Huh. That's
some good news. Right?
That is.
I wasn't aware of that. I just had a look at that myself, just out of interest.
So then it sounds like they created it separately to not have to create something new, which would be easier than changing the rules for something that's been around longer than Australia has been.
Yes. And I think, Dustin, that's where, you know, I raised that point of it's not, this is not a blow it all up and make it go away situation. This is a stepped approach. And I think it's probably the wisest given, you know, chaplaincy services in the Navy have been around for 108 years in Australia. And they've been primarily religious in for those 108 years. So this is not going to disappear overnight. I think the very cautious and sensible approach they've taken is to offer something which is sitting on alongside with the same pay scales, but within the same service as chaplains. And my personal hope is that the other services in Australia will see this and use it as a model. I really want to congratulate the Navy for being, you know, the first cab off the rank. It's not an easy decision, and it's a very brave decision, and they've really committed to it. They will have their first welfare officers employed very soon, I believe, and deployed within the Navy by next year.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and by next year as well. So from January next year, they'll all be wearing the new insignia, and those will be rolled out for chaplains and for the welfare officers. So the new insignia will be out as well by next year. So it looks like they've really made some good progress, and I believe that they have appointed already two welfare officers who will be starting very soon. So. Yeah, I mean, that's some really good news. They've really made some good progress there. So, yeah, I believe second half of this year, those two particular people that they're looking at to appoint, who I believe are both women, should be appointed, and they will be up and running very soon in those new roles.
Yeah.
So, look, again, it's not perfect. You know, we're not going to get radical change, but it's really good to see one of the services actually starting to introduce something which actually reflects the diversity of the Navy and the diversity of the Australian society, and really society worldwide, you know, in many cases. So
yeah,
it's good to see.
Wow. Yeah. When I was in the seminary, I looked at, I was actually president of the Chaplains Club very briefly, and was partway through the application process for the chaplain candidate program with the U.S. Army, and looking at all the requirements to become a chaplain, it was like, basically, once you're appointed and scheduled, you're trained and ready to go in 3 months. Okay. It wasn't even that. It was 6 weeks. You're trained and ready to go in 6 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's very quick.
The assumption was your training you need for your job, you've already gotten. You just need to learn how to not make a fool of yourself once you get to a unit.
Okay. Interesting. There you go.
So if you know, getting people appointed now, it's May, and having them, you know, on a ship in January, that seems perfectly reasonable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's really interesting. I think that there is an article that has been circulating in the Navy's own newspaper. All the services here have their own newspapers, and I think it actually makes, like, I had shared it with a number of people and had some relatively negative reactions. But I think once you dig into their approach, and I read the information in their article at face value, because I've had those conversations with people behind the scenes, I guess, I know that there is a lot of goodwill in the Australian Navy, and I really believe that they are genuine in going forward with this as a way of integrating these services that do the three things which I hold, you know, dear to me, you know, about hope, meaning, and listening. Mm-hmm. And they really, I think there's been some really good, as I said, some good intent behind to provide this for everyone. They really want to provide a service which is at the cutting edge, and actually reflects the values and of the people who are their audience and who are members of the Navy. So I can't speak highly enough of them because of the work that they've done behind the scenes. And I can't take really any credit for that. I think that a lot of what I happen to do is an exercise for me to wish to further my career has had some, you know, good timing, I guess, mm-hmm. is the best way to put it, for them, that, you know, they were trying to make a case for this, and then I came along and said, hey, you know, I'm interested too. And they've said, look, yeah, there is demand and people are actually watching and people are interested. You know, we need to make reform in this area. And, you know, hats off to them for actually deciding to do that and really pushing ahead with it.
All right. That is awesome news.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about this.
No problem at all.
It's always good to hear wins. And in 2020, it seems like we don't have many of them anywhere.
It's trying times, I think, generally for those of us who, you know, have a humanist kind of approach to life and, you know, are trying to really think that we need to be doing stuff which, you know, instills the value of human life, no matter who that life is, on the people's, on their own terms. Yeah, but, it's certainly some good news. And my hope would be that, I know it's being watched, as I said, in the UK for their services there. I hope it would be extended further here in Australia. And then there would be a case to extend it, you know, further into militaries and other places in the world if they're not already doing this kind of stuff. Yeah. I think it's a good start.
All right. Well, thank you for taking your lunch to talk to us.
No problem at all. You take care, mate.
All right.
To yourself and others.
And now it's time for some feedback from Avery, with a comment on the website. She wrote, I resonated quite a bit with the conversation about Satan. I think we all have vivid memories and subsequent nightmares of youth pastors from Bible camp preaching fire and brimstone sermons. Is it just me, or were all those types of pastors disturbingly obsessed with numerology and maniacally flipping back and forth between the Book of Daniel and Book of Revelation? The satanic character is badass. If we ignore what our psychotic pastors taught us, Lucifer gave God the middle finger, skydived from heaven, and brought forbidden knowledge to humans. We should all strive to be like Lucifer because hard truths are better than the blissful ignorance. Hashtag, what would Satan do? Hashtag, WWSD. Avery, you're totally right. I know I went through... I grew up in the Adventist church, and fire and brimstone was pretty much gone by the time I was old enough to remember things. They were trying to do the nice Jesus thing, but still a ton of numerology, lots of Daniel and Revelation. And then you get the Revelation seminars that come through town every so often with all Daniel and Revelation. And if I remember correctly from when you wrote in before, you're ex-Mormon, and that's interesting that it's all the same. And with apocalyptic death cults that are sure that the end of the world is nigh, it will all be the same. On YouTube, got a comment that is actually not just spam, from Adam. Hell is actually just a waiting room. The lake of fire refers to Gehenna, which is a basically never-ending burning pile of trash outside Jerusalem. So for one, if you believe in hell and the lake of fire, there are a bazillion different versions of what they actually are. And since the Bible doesn't actually say much about the lake of fire, other than that there is a lake of fire that Satan and his angels will be thrown into, and doesn't really say anything about hell, there's not a whole lot to go off of. All right, so that wraps it up for feedback. And if you want to reach out to us, you can leave a comment on the website or use the feedback form at atheistnomads.com/contact. And we did get a private message on there, which you can mark it private. And I will not read it on the show, but will write you back. I will get there. Sorry. Just been busy with stuff. And you can also hit us up on Twitter. Don't do the Facebook page. I barely spend any time on Facebook. Really probably should just shut down the Facebook page. If any of you want to make a compelling argument not to, let me know. Otherwise, I will finally make good on my threat to kill it. And if you want to support the show, you can find out how at atheistnomads.com/donate or go to patreon.com/atheistnomads. And that wraps it up for this week. I've got two interviews scheduled for this weekend and then one for the following weekend. I'll probably be doing a live stream here for episode 260 with the big camera, and it'll be really cool. The first live stream test with the part of the new setup went really well, and so we should be good. Now that wraps it up for this week. So remember, not all those who wander are lost.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find show notes and contact information at atheistnomads.com. Follow us on Twitter at Atheist Nomads and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/atheistnomads. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. And while you're there, feel free to leave us a review. Theme music is courtesy of Sturdy Fred. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.